Hello again.
Hello.
This is a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Gingell.
I'm Matthew Roberts.
We're talking about Otto Wagner. In the last episode, we had a brief sort of introduction to the world he was a young man in. Urban explosion of Ringstrasse era Vienna. His foray and early success in the property market. Now we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of early buildings, but we're also, in the last episode, we mentioned this, not exactly a kind of anything goes attitude, but the coexistence of a whole series of different styles within the sort of monumental fun park of the Ringstrasse. And I think that that apparent kind of permissiveness is the product of greater sort of uncertainty about in what style architecture ought to be built and what the aping of the styles of so many previous eras said about the 19th century in particular. So we're going to talk a little bit about that kind of debate and the way in which Wagner himself entered into it.
We should say we're going to be talking about some buildings, and there will be photographs of all of those buildings on our Instagram and on our Twitter. So do come over at @about_buildings, and the links are in the show notes, just so that you can have some visual aid to understand what we're talking about.
So what would you like to start off on? Do you want to talk about the bank?
I mean, well, I only have a few things to mention about. He quite early on, well, no, not that early on. I thought it was earlier than that. I think it comes up as early because most of the histories written about him completely ignore everything that goes on before he starts to become a heroic architect.
So this is the Länderbank of 1882. People are interested in it because the front and the back are very different.
It has various things going on that I think show even more than the apartment buildings we talked about last time, that he's freeing up. He doesn't really buy that you have to take the tenets of style building seriously. Yeah. You can just use it. He's kind of free using this stuff.
We could talk. The front is interesting, although it's interesting in the way that some of the other facades we talked about are. It has this like two-story rusticated layer at the bottom, with this quite interesting thing where basically it's all horizontal and no verticals. It's become pure kind of corduroy horizontality.
Nice deep yeah. Cut rustication.
Yeah, and it's got this rather sort of sweet little top layer with these little Baroque lozenge-shaped ovoid windows.
Well, firstly, it's got a really sweet plan. We've got to put that plan up. That's that top one.
Yeah, that's very nice.
There's this sort of rectangular block, and then that turns onto a kind of trapezoid with circles and arcs in it. And then the back of it's like a horseshoe, which is containing all the offices. It's a great plan.
That tendency to channel, I associate very strongly with Nicholas Hawksmoor. It's there very obviously on the front of St. Mary Woolnoth, where the kind of columns, the giant order columns that frame the facade, dissolve into stripiness. It's also there in John Soane as well. Outer walls of the Bank of England are rusticated in a very similar way. I mean, I guess if I was to think more about the effect of that, when you're walking along the street, when you're walking along the pavement on the same side of the road as the bank, that firm channeling rustication, that stripy rustication, as you kind of look up, it must really stretch the building in a certain way, because you see this like absolute rapid cascade of carved lines going up all the way up to the second, third story.
Yeah, it's a way to have fun with the length of these blocks, I guess. It's the sort of classic front, back, something cool in the middle plan, isn't it? As if it kind of pivots around one corner and it sort of opens up the space for the stairwell. Conceptually, it's a sort of poche plan, I guess. Round the back, the bank does something quite surprising, which is to absolutely strip away all ornamentation and language altogether. And instead, this horseshoe-shaped plan is, you see, as these like expressed vertical piers between the windows, which look like so many chimneys or something, like chimney stacks. And then, like, slightly, everything else is slightly pushed back. And then the whole thing's covered in render. And that's it.
It's really feeling industrial architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And inside, so the horseshoe itself has got a that shape courtyard, and then there's a ring of offices around the courtyard. So with lots of glazing on the outside, lots of glazing on the inside. The inside is kind of a compromise. It's rendered slightly, there's a little bit of like classical banding and profiling. And then the roof and an internal roof level of the courtyard is all made of like steel trusses, kind of very fine, but like definitely in the language of industrial architecture. And that's even for these bank workers. So there's a sort of front end for the clients, this grand thing with a rotunda and various rooms, and then that's connected to the kind of back offices by a room for tellers.
And this, in a way, I think is just following the logic of what architectural style does in this era, which is that it's become kind of instrumentalized, you know, it's got a certain sort of purpose, which means that it doesn't really have any innate standing anymore. It doesn't have any kind of, if you're just using it for certain purposes, then if that purpose doesn't exist, then why would you need it? Why would you have the kind of classical language around the back when that doesn't actually matter? So I think almost his first major public building is the synagogue in Budapest, which was, which year was this built in, Matt? I think this is even just...
It was built in 72, but there was a competition to design it that Wagner won, I think, in 68-ish. So it is really early for Wagner.
So Budapest had just become the other capital of the dual monarchy, which happened in 67.
Yes, sometime around then. There's the great Hungarian rebellion, and then it's crushed, and then it's under military government for a long time until they can kind of come up with a compromise, and the compromise is they get to exist as a sort of as a federal lair within the empire.
Yeah, constitutionally it becomes an empire and a kingdom, and the kingdom is Hungary and the empire is Austria.
Yeah.
Which is why, yes, Kaiser und Königlich is the K-U-K is the prefix applied to everything, which refers to those two identities. But you've actually been to this building, Matt.
I have, yeah. I went on holiday to Budapest a few years ago, and it was in quite a sorry state of repair then. I think it's had some work done to it subsequently. I think there's interesting things going on in the building that connect it to both Wagner's development and to broader conversations that are happening within Austro-Hungary and Europe about style and about architecture. I guess the first thing I wanted to say was that I was struck looking at the plan of the Landerbank, the last building that we were talking about, how it's quite a similar game being played with this synagogue building in Budapest, which is that you have a kind of rectilinear block facing onto the street that has been reskinned, in this instance, in a kind of Moorish or Byzantine language of pointed arches, but not Gothic pointed arches, but the kind of slightly shallower, almost like an ogee arch in the Gothic, and then polychromatic striped brick, yellow and red. So red brick interleaved with yellow paint, I think. I don't think the yellow blocks are stone blocks. I think we've got painted brick alongside unpainted brick. And then like really lots of applied terracotta cast into the sort of geometric shapes that are typical of, you know, Eastern Mediterranean and Moorish buildings.
Yeah, pulling a little sprinkle of the Alhambra, little sprinkle of the Mosque of Cordoba in the ornamentation.
Exactly. And then we have that square rectilinear block that faces onto the street. And then attached to the back of it, much like the Landerbank, you have a octagonal, in this case, centrally planned synagogue. This is my main recollection of the building. or the way that you enter the building is really interesting. You enter initially through quite a high arcaded loggia, and then you go in through a second set of doors, and the ceiling comes much lower. There's a very evocative section that I'll post on the Instagram and stuff, which I think will give you a sense of this, where the ceiling comes much lower and you're walking in, and that's because the raked seating of the gallery is directly above your head, but you can't see that because it's a low ceiling. And then suddenly you come out from underneath that and you're in this really high, centrally planned octagonal space with clear story lighting. So like a lantern, the roof goes way, way up, and there's windows up very high, bringing lots of light in to this centrally planned space. And then there's galleries all up sitting around. And so you come from the street, you're in this big high loggia, and then the ceiling comes very low and you walk in, and then suddenly it opens up again. And it has a real sense of drama. And this is added to by these very lushly coloured interiors, lots of deep midnight blues, reds, yellows. It's a very affecting building, and it also fits in between this patterned terracotta, this interest in kind of Eastern Islamic architecture as a kind of sculptural and decorative program. It made me think of lots of kind of arts and crafts buildings in Europe that are fetishizing and representing the Eastern Mediterranean and Islamic architecture to kind of be enjoyed by the imperial metropole.
Yeah, looking at photos, the colouring is sort of reminiscent of those sort of orientalizing buildings like Leighton House, but also the sort of mid-century bricky Gothic revival, things like All Saints Margaret Street. Yeah. And there was like a real English architecture and the kind of arts and crafts and the Gothic revival were very much read by this generation of German architects. They had a big effect on them.
Yeah, as I mean, England was generally the example in the middle of the 19th century as an advanced society at a time when these societies were still pretty early on in the stage of urbanization and industrialization. Because they were early on in this state, but had sort of seen, there was kind of an inkling, I think, even in the 1840s and 50s, of what was going to happen to Germany. In Germany, unlike, and by Germany, I mean the German-speaking countries, which are not united at all, is a sort of sense of a question. Whereas, I mean, there were questions in British architecture at the time, people arguing about, Gothic revival, all those people like Ruskin. But in Germany, I feel there was a more complicated debate, partly because at that time, German universities were expanding enormously, and German intellectual culture was expanding enormously. And one of the questions they start to ask is, what does this mean? How should we build? What does style mean? How is modernity going to exist in?
There's a wider anxiety about architectural style and about the failure of the 19th century to come up with an architectural style of its own. You know, in all the buildings that we've talked about, what we're seeing is the harvesting and recycling, often very kind of fluidly and very enjoyably, of motifs and examples from the whole of history, from this kind of enormous corpus of very well, increasingly well understood and exhaustively surveyed architecture. But there's nothing new.
Yeah, it almost feels like from the end of the 18th century onwards, people can suddenly go further, Europeans. They suddenly start seeing all of these interesting, exotic, ancient and foreign cultures. They also start traveling around their own countries and begin developing sort of ideas of a national past. And they kind of get high off this repeated realms of discovery, disentangling the heroic past, like, and go through waves of reinterpretation of what ancient Greece is like, or of what classical history is like in Italy, or what the Gothic North. At the end of that, they're left with, okay, we've now got all of these different disciplines of different, like, styles of architecture, all of which seem to float remarkably lightly, yeah, and seem to be kind of
And as like we talked about in the last episode with some of the buildings, they're really applying like the language of the heroic north or
whatever it happens
to
be, the
civilizing whatever, the Egyptian prison, to buildings which are increasingly modern, complex plans.
Yeah, enormous.
Which just do not exist in, they certainly don't exist in the ancient, like, Teutonic past, but they don't even really exist in terms of the Baroque either, and it's increasingly dressing.
And they also have the benefit, increasingly, of new ways of building and new materials, which also, you know, we talked about iron, we've got increasingly got a lot of glass. We have the ability to mass produce all sorts of elements in a way which wasn't possible in the past, with like your sort of ceramics, your faience, all these kinds of things.
It's easy to forget how far, very quickly, a lot of these things were pushed in small specific cases. I mean, if you look at like Viollet-le-Duc's proposals with iron, he's very quickly going to like strange sort of sci-fi trusses, which then I guess go forward to things like the Bibliothèque Nationale, where you've got incredibly fine expressive ironwork, or quite, you know, by the 1860s there are a very small number of buildings which are completely clad in glass. So these ideas were around, but
there's sort of a realization that skinning a building to be like an Italian palazzo is a bit strange. The city that you're building it within bears absolutely no relation to a sort of Renaissance Italian city. You know, between the emergence of transport infrastructure, railways, just the sheer scale of the urban megalopolis and metropolis that's emerging in this period, there's kind of a jarring realization that people are starting to have and thinking, why do our buildings look like buildings that belong to very different polities and cities to the one that we live in today?
But mostly people weren't thinking that.
Yes. People who know a lot about architecture and who are very involved with it start to worry about this kind of thing, but the general public was perfectly happy with just making everything look Baroque forever.
And actually, even the academics who are supposedly worried about this are kind of arguing between, I've got a great new idea, we should do a Baroque revival but modern, versus, I've got a great new idea, lads, we should just do a Baroque revival.
Well, I mean, the Vienna opera that we talked about, I think was a kind of progressive, sort of quite Semperian sort of building at the time that it was done. It looks very old-fashioned now, but I think that was part of what made it.
Yeah, it's meant to be. I don't understand Semper at all. Do you understand him? Because I think if we don't understand him at all, we can say we're going to look this up at some other time in the future and put it on the shelf. But if you've got some idea of what's going on there,
maybe I could just say one or two things about the sort of style problem generally. So there's a discussion of style and people writing essays called things like, in what style should we build? In Berlin, there is a push made by various people towards moving away from the sort of severe Greek trabiated way.
Yeah, like Schinkel, post-Schinkel classicism of Berlin.
Where you have, like columns and lintels.
I hate the word trabiated, by the way.
Okay.
It just means like, lintels. It just means like posts and pillars. Yeah. Like posts and beams.
But there's an attempt to do the round arch style.
But they're both like euphemisms, right? When they say trabiated, they mean mock Greek. Yeah. And when they say round arch, they mean either Renaissance, mock Renaissance, or mock Roman.
but the rationalization for this is made in connection with materials. Yeah. Because they're building with sandstone. The reason why Greek architecture works so wonderfully is because you can span really long distances with marble. You can do like an 8 meter long. Yeah. So there's a kind of argument made from materials, and this, I think, the whole way of understanding this is that people start thinking about the connection between style and material, technology, the way in which all of those things are innately connected, and in which style is sort of the product of a particular era and a particular kind of set of circumstances. And
it's a really funny idea, don't you think? That's a funny, I mean, the like core of the idea, which is that like stuff arises from circumstances. But the Greeks didn't ever build arches because they didn't really seem to adopt that technology.
They didn't need it.
You could say that. I mean, but I mean, they weren't really trying to build those buildings, right? They didn't have big office buildings. They didn't really have big buildings at all.
Yeah, there's a bunch of debates going around in like the 1830s and 40s around all of this. And the round arch style is seen as being a bit more progressive.
It's like, let's go back to the 1400s, not let's go back to the 400s.
I'll just draw like a line through two other people. So there's Karl Butticher, who's another person writing around then, who he has a sort of theory of what he's trying to explain essentially is like, why is there Gothic architecture and also Greek architecture, which are sort of manifestly incompatible? He comes up with a story about how they both arise out of a certain like attempt to create, you know, interior space out of materials, a sort of certain structural principle which is generative, and the way in which all of that joins together. It, you know, sort of with the Greek it's like posts and beams, as you say, and with the Gothic it is columns and arches and vaults, and each of them having sort of arrived at that invention is able to kind of continuously elaborate and progress, but it's as if they're on separate tracks from that point onwards. And so they exist kind of in their own universes. It's not possible for them to talk to or really understand one another. Logically, that then points the way towards the idea that in the modern era, we would need to think about what would arise from the particular materials and things that we have. Semper has a little triad of the things which he says produce form, which are these separately evolving parts, which are a tectonic structure, like a kind of structure of interlocking bits, something which is a sort of base or kind of sort of mass, something which is like a sort of a covering in the way of a fabric, and there's one other one which I can't remember.
Oh, is this like the idea of like this is how architecture like originates in deep time, and yeah, it's like structures, envelopes, skins and masses or something, yeah, and they're like, and there's some sort of deep time theory about how it comes from rush mats and columns.
Yeah, and they have their own separate kind of tracks and kind of evolve into, yeah, in their own way, and all sort of interact in their own way. I
mean, but what he actually produces with this, The thing that I find like difficult to kind of get my head around is that like what he produces with this are designed for things which is, well, the two things I know of his are he was famously ripped off for the Opera House in Bayreuth, which is quite a building. It's this huge theatre sort of stage. It's a bit like the National Theatre in Vienna that we were talking about earlier, in terms of its massing. And also, he laid out the plan for the Kaiser Forum, which was going to be the big central thing on the Ringstrasse, which is a complex of Baroque palace buildings containing museums and palaces around a square, which would form the anchor, kind of the new Vienna. They're remarkably like grand Baroque palaces with the same sort of huge primary forms at the level of massing and grand Baroque detailing. Mm-hmm. And it feels like there's a great theoretical construction going on, saying we've got to take architecture back to its fundamental principles. We have to be true to our like age, our zeitgeist, and understand the sort of like incompatibilities of certain ideas of style and produce sort of Baroque, yeah, architecture.
Well, I mean, Semper's idea that all style must ultimately stem from a kind of progressive process of materiality and of using materials and of technology, it is an innovative idea, but it is also a very old one in architecture. Like Vitruvius writes about the way that classical language comes out of and doffs its cap to the wooden origins of architecture. That's there in Vitruvius, the idea that classical detailing is a petrification, a sort of making into stone of wooden detailing.
Yeah, although I would say he's almost telling more stories.
Yes, there are different things going on, because so one of the things in, yes, there's a story about metamorphosis. One of the ways that all of these theories kind of hedge their bets is that they, on the one side, say everything is about purpose, material, technology. It arises out of, like, fundamentally a sort of realist engagement with pragmatic sort of existence as it actually is, yada, yada, yada. And then on the other hand, they say, but also there's continuity. Everyone develops by mimicking things which came in the past and making small changes to them. And that continuity, as you say, can also be seen through the metamorphosis of a wooden thing into a stone thing, as Vitruvius talked about, or like the way in which ornament, which is sort of, what's the word for this? I can't remember. There's a skeuomorph, as the idea of a skeuomorph actually comes from these theories of where it's a mark of use, but in a different context, and then which becomes purely like ornamental when it's transferred over. And I can't remember the examples of where you have things which sort of start off as like practical clay vessels and end up being sort of turned into these kind of curiously like ritualized forms of ornamentation. In all of this like style conversation, the big idea seems to be all of these things necessarily evolve out of a confrontation with the kind of external reality and conditions of possibility of building and interacting with materials. And somewhere in all of that is something kind of primal and fundamental and outside of art or tradition or the canon or whatever. But it's also innately sort of focused and channeled and sort of necessarily civilized by your kind of knowledge and all of the kind of history and all of the kind of conceptual understanding which the artist brings to it.
The thing about George's point that Semper's buildings never really live up to his rhetoric, I think is a point that Semper himself realized. I've got a quick quote here that I'll read from a lecture that Semper gave in Zurich in 1860, just before he left for Vienna to begin his work on the Ringstrasse. He said, "People reproach us architects for a lack of inventiveness. Too harshly, since nowhere has a new world historical idea pursued with force and consciousness become evident. We are convinced that wherever such an idea will really take the lead, one or the other of our young colleagues will prove himself capable of endowing it with a suitable architectural dress. Until that time comes, however, we must reconcile ourselves to make do as best we can with the old."
Which sounds like remarkable foresight, because it would happen. But all these people are kind of like trying to, they're really, it feels with hindsight, like they're really trying to wrap their heads around the idea of what the future is going to be like, and that it's not going to be historicist or Baroque. And they kind of, they're so close intellectually to what it's going to mean, but they are completely stymied by this inherited culture that they just cannot move beyond. Like they're right walking up to the idea that, I mean, even my objection to the word trabiated, I object to the word trabiated because it's a way of sort of eliding two things. It literally means beams and posts, but it doesn't mean beams and posts. They're not talking about the problem of beam and post architecture. They don't mean like we shouldn't build concrete slab blocks, we shouldn't build strange pergolas, we shouldn't build Chicago skyscrapers with exposed steelwork or whatever, all of which would be trabiated. They mean we shouldn't build Greek, because their thinking is completely in these tunnels.
It's an attempt to rationalize style by going like one level deeper than style. Yeah, so style is all about structure, and then structure is actually all about materials and technology and some kind of indefinable core idea of the moment. And
whereas then actually it's kind of very cultural.
Yeah,
it's very much culture and fashion.
Like, and it's ironic because the last thing they want to be is fashion. The last thing they want to be is kind of superficial culture. But that is ultimately always what... like the public debates around architecture that we've alluded to become. They always become about the kind of the image of the building as a kind of passing fad, as a trend.
Fundamentally, you can do absolutely loads of different things with brick and stone architecture. Like, actually, if their mind was able to, like, encompass it and someone was willing to buy it, you can do loads of different things. Like, the possibilities are literally endless. And in a way, that's the problem.
We interrupt the program at this point to bring you a quick word from our sponsor, Blue Crow Media. Blue Crow Media are publishers of architectural city maps. We've talked about them on the podcast before, but they've got a whole new range of maps forthcoming, a Hawksmoor one.
Very much up our in our wheelhouse. I think they haven't drawn the pentagrams and things on already. You'll have to provide those yourself.
I haven't had sight of this one yet because I know it's a new release. Yeah, so I'm not clear how much the occult signification has been integrated. Also in the pipeline, I know, are Venice, Prague and various others. So a bit of Austro-Hungarian synergy. Within the existing range, they've got maps of Paris, London trees, Pyongyang, all sorts of different ones. You can go onto their website to browse the range. It's at bluecrowmedia.com. And if you do choose to buy, remember to use the offer code, which is about buildings, all one word, to get 10% off at checkout. So thanks a lot to Blue Crow Media, and on with Otto Wagner.
Anyway, I think that sort of sets up the basic bedrock for what we're going to talk about next. So we're going to kind of skip on a little tiny bit in time. Suffice to say, in other episodes, we will cover Otto Wagner having a fantastic career, and he becomes appointed the head of the architecture school, yes, or one of the twin heads, I'm not entirely sure, yes, and he writes a great theoretical work for his students, training up the next generation of architects that are going to build the Vienna megacity and the bright world of tomorrow, many of whom will actually go on to become fairly substantial architects. And he writes them a book, a primer. It's called Modern Architecture, which is a title which sounds like it's, you know, that's promising a lot to us looking backwards. It's short, and I think we should go through what his take on all of these principles is.
Yeah, so he has, the book has, is it five parts?
They are the architect, style, composition, construction, the practice of art, and then there's a brief conclusion. Do you want me to go through it? I've got notes on each section.
Yeah, why don't you lead us through it, and we can add if we've got anything else.
Okay, I'm going to like go through this at a trot, yeah, as a bit of a travesty. In the section, the architect, he basically says, young students, you are joining a tremendous and exclusive club, and you've got to live up to a lot. Architects are fantastic and have to be brilliant at lots of things, and really, it's very hard. You know, it's just this sort of like stoking up of what the architect's going to be. And the architect is a kind of romantic artist hero.
They have to synthesize two different things, don't they? Because they have to both be very able to read needs and to fundamentally understand the possibilities of building art. But also they have to be able to take the everyday and elevate it through art into something which kind of enters the realm of the ideal.
And they have to be able to understand so many different things. This and that and the other thing. Technology, construction, drawing, be artist livers, struggle. You're going to struggle for many years.
They have to master the tools necessary to communicate this process to the public as well. It's certainly in that opening section, he's very much stressing that architects should be drawing better perspectives of their proposed buildings so that the public can really get excited about what's coming. They should be using less jargon so that they can explain to people outside of the profession what they're trying to do with their buildings. It is very reminiscent of, well, I guess, conversations about architects that happen all the time in all ages.
I know, some things never change.
Certain amount of it is like stuff which is now taken as platitude, I would say. Yeah. Like, which has been said, and a certain amount of it is something slightly different.
I just wanted to say that the language of it
There's a lot of internet block capital, which I really like.
He's quite acerbic. He really gets to the point about things. Yes, the thing he talks about the like foolishness of public judgment, which he doesn't particularly. Yes, indifferent and foolish judgment that greets even the greatest works of art.
I guess when I was talking about like the architect is going to be this sort of hero class, yeah. That's kind of what he means. Like he's a bit like, you're going to have to be really tough, but also you're going to just have to cope with everyone being an idiot, and you're just going to have to make it work.
And he's unashamedly elitist as well. He thinks that big part of the problem is that too many commissions are decided by people who don't have proper training in art, and that the selection process should also be dominated by people.
And there are too many bad architects. Too many people have been allowed to do buildings. Though we're not strict enough at preventing bad people from doing buildings. Yeah, it's this like real elite message. The next part,
style,
is style, and in a way, it's his take on what we've just been discussing with people like Semper and these approaches of different styles. And I would say the core, he talks many different things in this section, but the core is the idea that like just dressing something up in the idea of a historicist style isn't good enough. Yeah. We are in a different time. Like we have different tools at our disposal, and we have a different culture, and we have different needs, and it's kind of hopeless to try and just say it's not good enough to just try and just say let's do it Gothic, or an architect could be a Gothic architect or a not, you know, or a classicist. We have to try and make a modern architecture.
In one of his capital letter interludes, he says, it may be accepted as proven that art and artists have always represented their epoch. And he talks about how the Greeks in the formative period of their style were not conscious of a contrast between their style and the Egyptian, yada, 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 yada. So that there's a kind of style, real style is unselfconscious because it's like immediately and necessarily connected to the present.
And then he talks about, imagine like the time of Louis XIV. Imagine all the clothes people are wearing. Yes. Imagine ancient Rome. Imagine what everyone's dressed up like. Yeah. And then look at Vienna. It's not like that. Yes. Yes. It would look ridiculous. Yes. Think about how stupid someone would look if they were dressed in Elizabethan costume walking down the Ringstrasse. Yes. They would look very out of place. And yet, look what we do to our buildings. They should be ridiculed.
Yeah.
They are out of fashion, out of time. Yes. That's his criticism of it.
His argument is all very aesthetic. Yeah, he had this. It's a nice passage. He talks about how the brightly coloured Greek temples and the like brown of their skin are in the Mediterranean sun are like so wonderfully harmonised. It's very very lush. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a bit later on when like he says, Ottoman carpets, we can't use them in Vienna. you know, they just don't go with the light.
He's also aware, I think, of that the self-consciousness of 19th century historicist style is also a product of the fact that we know so much that there's a sort of unprecedented profusion of art historical and architectural historical knowledge, that the kind of copybook of all of human history is laid out before architects of 19th century Europe, and that they, from their access to these resources of knowledge, can kind of pluck anything they like, but that this kind of makes even more empty this process. This process becomes even more empty because they can just, they have so much knowledge at their fingertips of historical style.
So the next section is a really interesting section. When I was looking at this quite early on from the point of view of like modernism and seeing how much not modernist this guy is, having just had the style section, which makes him seem very like a forebear of modernism. This is like, we've got to do the new style.
Out with the olds.
The next section is composition.
Yes.
And it's a really nice thing because we haven't really, in all of our discussions of architectural history texts, architectural theory texts, had someone go, it's best to concentrate on like the one point perspective. Like if you've got if you're looking from a shallow vantage point, use shallow decoration. If you're looking from a long vantage point, use deep decoration. Symmetry is extremely important in massing. You know, consider
your facade from a small number of like key vantage points. Consider it from the great city, where like a key object has got to have a mass on the horizon, and consider it from a key controlled 1-point vantage point where it should be composed correctly. The way in which drawings and models as tools of composition can interact. And this is very much not modernist. This feels like good Beaux-Arts, like clear thinking about the painterly construction of facades and masses of buildings. He also says there's no point, like, if you're not good at it, this isn't going to be very helpful.
Yes. There's nothing rational about this. Yeah. You need to have a sensibility, and you need to have an innate, he talks about, you need an innate predisposition, and then you need about 20 years of the right sort of training, which goes through various stages. And without both of those things, you just can't do it.
Yeah, but here are some sort of basic techniques. Yeah. Buildings should be symmetrical. You know, we were discussing those lovely plans earlier, which are a kind of construction to make a weirdly shaped site into a succession of not platonic, but like orthogonal forms that are like clearly recognizable. He likes in composition readable forms. He wants the mass to be readable. He wants the building to kind of like, you should know where you are. The building should help situate you and locate you. It's nice stuff.
You also need self-confidence. You've got to believe in yourself, which is very anime kind of.
But I think it's true. I mean, I disagree with symmetry. I think you can have it one way or the other. But like a lot of this stuff, the idea that like a form should be readable.
Yeah.
It should be clear. You shouldn't be mealy-mouthed in your attempt to like in a composition. It should be substantial, real, confident.
Yeah.
If you're not confident in it, it won't come out confident.
Yeah.
I think that's all quite right.
Yeah.
And if you're rubbish at it, it's going to be a bit rubbish probably.
And he does also say something which will come into the next part, which is this line essentially taken from the Arts and Crafts, that nothing which is not practical can be beautiful.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what he means by that.
Yes, because the practicality, something which he's able to do all sorts of different things with, he does not mean that nothing which is not utilitarian can be beautiful. This allows him to sort of discount all sorts of approaches which he finds reactionary or kind of purposeless or kind of unexamined or like overly traditional. So for example, the votive church, this like a Gothic building, which is the first thing built on the Ringstrasse, absolutely he doesn't like aesthetically, and he talks about it as being unsuccessful practically. I don't think that this is really true, but he says like, oh, bits are falling off it.
Yeah, people say that about everything. Whatever. Like, take it or leave it. I mean, that's a kind of a problem of detailing. Although in this text, the general style is like, it goes along with a fair clip. It's got lots of block capitals, like, emphasising his points. It's a clear polemic. He also, at other points, is like, kind of goes back on himself and is very unclear. Like, he's at some points he seems to be suggesting there should be, like, an overarching state aesthetic authority. And then he sort of says, well, if we do that, it's just going to be run by like busybodies and it's going to be rubbish. So he hasn't kind of nailed everything. The next section, these sections are all quite short, so I think we can, is construction, which is like, if we hadn't reading this the first time without like doing too much of the like background research on what was going on at the time, some of this doesn't really make any sense. Because sure, the basic point seems to be we've got different technology. The construction technology makes a difference, how you're building things. But then he sort of outlines some of this strange Semperian theory about partitions and things, which, just based on the text that's here, it just sounds a bit like gobbledygook.
Well, why are you talking about this? Yes, I mean, there's a key point about precedence, though, which is that he says that there's always construction first, and then the task of art or architecture is like to take construction and elevate it into something which is beautiful. I think that maybe that's just like a sort of, that's the pathology of, you know, the jaded present day, that we think that there is a difference, you know, that something being beautiful is different from it being practical.
Well, there is an interesting moment where I think it does prefigure the conversations of modernism that would come in the 20th century. We suddenly have appearing the figure of the engineer, who is someone who I'm not sure would appear in the sort of earlier style discourses earlier on in the 19th century. The engineer who does not consider the nascent art form, but only the structural calculation and the expense, will therefore speak a language unsympathetic to man, while, on the other hand, the architect's mode of expression will remain unintelligible if, in the creation of the art form, he does not start from construction. Both are great errors. But by sort of saying there that there's this synergy that we have to bring together the expertise of the engineer as a kind of professional figure and then the sort of architect as a professional figure, it seems to prefigure some of the discourse of, like, Le Corbusier, for example.
Those passages in Le Corbusier, I thought, yeah, that he must have read this book, don't you think? I mean, I think actually Wagner just thinks that architects should understand construction. I don't think he thinks that we really need engineers.
Yeah, no, I think he thinks that like having engineers is a sign of weakness, yeah. Which I'm sympathetic with. Not that they're a sign of weakness, but that architects should be, like, I think it's a massive failure if you don't understand the kind of order of magnitude calculation level of, like, how things fit together. It, like, lots of people don't, and it hamstrings them in terms of design. And oh, and the fundamental thing is, all of this doesn't have, you still have to make it good.
Yes. So
like, you can have a new construction technique, new technology, and everything it can be is rubbish until someone has worked out how to make it aesthetic.
But there's no new invention without new construction. Like, the way that new architecture comes into the world is that there are new purposes, like new things that you're trying to do. There are new ways of achieving them. And then there is, like, the synthesis, the, like, integration of all of that reasoning by the complete artist, architect, who is able to turn them into new forms and to make them speak to the epoch and the people who may be too stupid to understand them.
It's so funny because you just see this, like, struggle between set ideas people have got in their heads, because I don't believe that at all. I think, like, you don't need new purposes or new building technologies to create new styles. You just kind of need, like, cultural dynamism. And there's nothing wrong with that. Because, I mean, also, like, the way people look at things is culturally determined as well. So the way people appreciate...
He ends with, I mean, the last thing that he talks about in this chapter is iron.
And in a way, he says a sort of complicated set of things about iron. Like, yeah, it's really powerful. You can do all sorts of really cool things with it. Lots of the things people have done with it have been bad because they haven't thought about it hard enough. Yeah. And it's a wonder material of the future. But people have got to crack the nut with using the power of architecture.
Yes, it's been overestimated. It's been used too obtrusively. It hasn't been properly, and I mean, we'll see. Like, he's got all sorts of strange and wonderful things that he does with iron himself.
It's a great period, early iron architecture. There's some really cool buildings.
At this point, people have been worrying about what the effect of iron on architecture, like, for about 60 years when he's writing this. So, like, you know.
Yeah, they've already done quite a lot of the cool ones. Yeah. The next section, which is called The Practice of Art, really feels like a grab bag of all of the things he didn't manage to get into the other sections.
Yeah.
He starts with, what's the practice? Yeah, you've heard me talk about the practice of art. What's necessary to do good art? It's good to do good drawings. Yeah. And he discusses good drawings. Like, they shouldn't be too flashy. You shouldn't have too much stuff on them just for presentation. Perhaps just a little bit of tasteful flowered borders. And judging by his back catalogue, like, you know, some tasteful female nudes crouching in the corner. That's another thing that just comes from a completely different... The idea that, like, okay, you're making these presentational drawings. He's literally devoting a section to it, to talking about what you put around the sort of fluff border around the drawing to make it look cooler. Like, no one's been teaching that in architecture school for a long time. And then he goes into a section about city planning.
Yes.
And he talks about trains and squares and the width, the ratio of the width and length of a road, and how, like, if a square's really big, it should be divided. If it's small, that's fine, but you should bear in mind the, like, ratio of its width to the height of the building surrounding it. Trains.
You can have underground trains. They're invisible, but rather boring to go on and very expensive. Or you can have high-level trains. They're cheaper, but rather intrusive in the street, but you get a great view as you whiz past all the buildings. He doesn't like gardens. He thinks there's a mania for putting gardens in squares, yeah, and that they destroy the architectonic power of the ground plane.
He had some, I mean, he's got some very catty things to say here. He says, the supporters of this view inevitably use innumerable bombastic catchphrases such as feast for the eyes, breathing centre, absorber of nitrogen, etc. These catchphrases are then dressed in popular slogans and thrown to the masses with every possible hygienic reason being given. Whether such plans are also beautiful is never considered. He then says, in Vienna, one of the largest squares, the Rathausplatz, 80,000 square metres, has been successfully robbed of any artistic effect by an absurd garden and defiled by a monstrous pathway that scorns every practical need.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good strident. It's a good strident, like, nutty architecture stuff is kind of creeping into this
section. I was a little bemused by some of this stuff. Like, why? what is it actually that he has an issue with? For a minute, I thought he was kind of like talking about kind of Jane Jacobs style. We don't want to have excessively big open spaces, but that's not actually what. Is he just purely talking about like the decisions of the landscape? What is his beef with the kind of ornamental garden as a model?
He thinks that gardens are less interesting than big squares.
Yeah.
Now, like, he thinks that, like, St. Mark's is cooler than a garden because the garden is kind of, like, fluffy and indeterminate and weak. And, like, this grand public space is strong and powerful and delineated.
Yeah, he thinks that the city should be a composition of architecture.
Energetic and tough and strong and not frou-frou.
I think he's sort of pushing back against a sort of slightly comfy, cozy.
He's anti the English house, yeah, big style.
I mean, the other big figure in Austrian, in like Viennese urbanism at this time is Camillo Zitta, who is very much in favour of the kind of irregular, romantically
composed. He's a
kind
of Pugin for the city.
Yeah, Pugin for the square, basically. Yeah. Like, he has a particular, his ideal square is the square with the David in Florence, which has got this sort of irregular composition, yeah, and like all of these, this sort of very, very interesting and variable effect. But obviously, Wagner's not having any of that. He thinks that things should be.
Yeah, Wagner wants a massive grid of equally sized slab blocks, yeah, with nice, wide, bare roads in them without any cables.
Yeah.
Beyond the Ringstrasse period, Wagner is very engaged actively in the continuing plans for the urban design of Vienna. And he has all sorts of schemes which we'll come to.
And he does a whole book on it, of which this is kind of the first, not draft, but inkling of his approach to urban planning.
I've got a wonderful quotation here where he says, looking forward to the glorious future, without doubt, the day can and must come when nothing visible to the eye is made without the sanction of art. Well, finally, ugliness will be illegal.
He does imagine in the conclusion, well, is it at this point or in the conclusion when he imagines, like, the state taking over the supervision of the making of everything, every object, yeah, every building, everything, and everything has to go through the aesthetic authority to make sure it is beautiful.
Yeah. We flashed forward. He was writing this in his, like, 50s and 60s when he'd become a professor. Like, he was elected, like, an imperial professor of architecture at the university, and he seems to have pretty much immediately gone extremely maverick and started causing trouble. You know, like, having sort of spent all of this time and he'd done, like, various commissions and he'd really tried to, like, become, to, like, get the favour of the establishment and this kind of thing and to become very successful. And then he immediately starts being quite incautious and throwing his weight around in all sorts of ways.
Don't you feel this is partly the classic architectural radicalising effect of, like, dealing with planning problems?
Yeah.
You just have to be nice to so many people. And you really see all of these idiots saying incredibly stupid things again and again. And you just start to have some increasingly strident thoughts in your mind, don't you find?
Yeah, right.
Until you go,
nothing. None of these people should touch anything. No one should be allowed to, like, move a pencil until I have said it's okay.
It should be bad. Well, he does subscribe to the view that the dress of the people inside the rooms should be appropriate to the spaces. The appearance and occupation of the inhabitant should harmonise with the appearance of the room. It is simply an artistic absurdity that men in evening attire, in lawn tennis or bicycling outfits, in uniform or checkered breeches, should spend their life in interiors executed in the styles of past centuries.
I mean, I think what he's saying there is more reasonable than kind of what you might be about to accuse him of
saying. Yeah. No, he's not quite gone to the... Some architects of this period are like, well, you're in the bedroom, so you've got to wear your lime green dressing gown, sir. But like...
I mean, this is another fixation that's going to be hanging around 30 years later, right? With the wonder material of the future jersey.
Oh, like Loess's book. Yeah. Loess's book on clothes.
Yeah. Not enough of that around, to be honest.
But they in all different... I mean, they all mean different things, though. One of which is you've got to be appropriate at the time. The aesthetic people really are like, no. That mauve jacket simply will not do in the green room. And Loess is like, we're going to wear jersey because then we can become like Nietzschean supermen with like our rugged pecs from all our exercise. So where do you think this book leaves us? It's called Modern Architecture. It's calling for a new style. It says things have it's like vitally important that people like build appropriate for the 19th century or the coming 20th century. But it's a really curious product of its time and a really curious product of a very particular person.
I don't know what to make of it because it doesn't seem... I think that you could make this book mean all sorts of things which are quite different from what the architecture ends up being like. And, you know, like the later buildings we will see have all sorts of very futuristic things. The stone has become sort of cladding.
Well, he even says it here. He says, like, we should go towards panel cladding.
Yeah.
And because we've gone towards panel cladding, instead of making it out of limestone, we can have panel cladding of marble because it's much less of it, so it can be fancier.
And there'll still be, like, statues with wreaths on the, you know, on the heroic order.
But at the same time, I know the fashion is now to go, he's not modernist. And I know his heart and his intellect wasn't going in that direction. But he is. He is obviously an important progenitor of modernism. Just look at the buildings. They're really heading hard in a modernist direction by the end. So, I mean, whatever he's thinking about, just because he can't make the entire intellectual leap doesn't mean he's not there.
There's a great quote in the intro, in the preface to this, which is from someone criticizing student work produced by his students. They said, "What brutal license side by side with fully conscious degeneration? What disgraceful concessions to an annoying originality and dilettantism? In this wild torrent, here and there was a flash of real talent, but no helmsman to steer, no master to take control. This tidal wave gushing forth into the complete untold, unknown, untamed." The buildings must, and the design and the work must have been doing something radical, because otherwise why would people be writing about it like that?
Oh, just because the general public are just very ignorant, aren't they?
Looking at these cities as well, I have another comment, which is that the buildings that in the tourist brochures of many cities in Europe are seen as utterly symbolic of the Ancien Régime, the Budapest Parliament, these Vienna palaces, the front of Buckingham Palace. So many of them are finished basically in the 20s.
Yeah.
They are post this. None of them existed like in any real built form until like 1870. They've kind of successfully retconned themselves into the kind of mental image of the city. There is something incredibly powerful about this period of historicist architecture. But the chocolate box quality of the Ringstrasse means that, in a way, what it's like is like you go around and you see these buildings and you think, aha, these are funny stylist buildings. And then you look at the Baroque ones, which are another, and they think, oh, naturally part of the Baroque inheritance of the city. Despite the fact they're being possibly some of the older ones. I mean, newer ones. So it's weird how it's all shaken out.
Well, I think we should probably draw to a close there.
We're going to, next week, or next time, we're going to be doing a whole load of buildings.
Yeah.
And we're going to tackle the period that he is most famous for, which is the Vienna Art Nouveau, the Secession.
Yes.
And the work around that.
And also his, and then in the one after that, we'll be talking about his kind of probably most significant or largest architectural legacy, which is the infrastructure of the city of Vienna itself, the rail, the canal, all this kind of stuff. So, which is all great fun. There's bonus material, if this isn't enough for you, on our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/about_buildings. And as we mentioned at the start, images of everything that we talk about will be appearing on our social media, Instagram, Twitter, @about_buildings.
And if you enjoy the show, do give us a review on your podcast app, because it helps other people to find us.
Good. Right. Well, thanks a lot for listening, and speak to you again.
Very soon.
Soon.
Very soon.